May it please the Court, my name is Howard Feldman. I represent Robert Gunville and Richard Oakley, two former employees of the Illinois Department of Corrections, who filed a claim based upon what they believed was their wrongful layoff based upon political reasons and their denial of due process rights in the manner in which the layoff recall process works. And I want to use the word recall list.
Can I just ask you very quickly, did the plaintiffs ever issue a notice of deposition for Mr. Snyder?
No, Your Honor, we did not, and we did not because we had been, and the reason we had the letter from his counsel is we knew that he was not going to testify, and that may have been an error on my part not to do that and ask him a bunch of questions, ask him a group of questions that would have then gotten Fifth Amendment denials and then be able to get have inferences, Your Honor, but that case, there was a situation that was pending in a lower court in this building, and so I did not, and I don't think that's relevant, but I think that's what premised that situation. But he had testified in a companion case, in a different case about the same layoff list. And what we know from Mr. Snyder is that his basic statement was he didn't know anything at all about these lists and that he would do anything he was told to do. And as we look at this set of circumstances, what our position is, you can't isolate on any single fact. It's like looking at a painting. If you get up close with a magnifying glass at a painting, you will see brush strokes. You won't see a picture. But if you step back far enough so you can see the whole picture, you in fact have a story. And that is what took place here. There's a set of circumstances. Mr. Oakley and Mr. Gunville had long histories with the Illinois Department of Corrections. What is clear is that no one within line authority at that department was involved in the selection of whatever positions were reduced. Also, any claims that this was done for budgetary or financial reasons, there's not a shred of paper anywhere from anyone prior to the layoff happening indicating by laying off these many people, we save this kind of money.
Did the plaintiffs ever challenge the new CMS interpretation of the recall rule in the state courts or in any state venue?
No, Your Honor, we did not challenge the CMS situation. And going to that issue is that Mr. Gunville had been assigned to oversee two separate projects that were for construction of new prisons, one in White County, which is really far, far southern Illinois, Carmine, which is closer to Kentucky than it is to Chicago, across the river, actually, and one in Hopkins Park, which is in Kankakee County. He was placed on the Kankakee County recall list, which is very convenient. There are no IDOC facilities in Kankakee County.
But how do you respond to the argument that we lack jurisdiction to review how a state agency construes state rules?
I believe that the rule, I don't believe that there was any really construction of it. I believe the testimony of the witness from the Department of Corrections, or excuse me, from CMS was, this is the way they did it, and this is the way they historically did it. But if and I'm not sure that that deposition actually is in the record. As I sit here, I saw the court look over at the clerk, and I'm going, did I put that? Is that in the record in the floor? I don't know that that was raised in the summary judgment, so I should probably not get too far afield. The bottom line is we did not challenge that in a state court proceeding, and we have not challenged that anywhere. But going back to the, unless the court wants me to continue with the layoff list.
Just argue the way you wish to argue.
I'm fine to take any direction from anybody. But the bottom line is that when this process started, we had a personnel director who was retiring, Nancy Bounds. We have a new personnel director who appears, doesn't even apply for the job, has zero personnel experience, is a political person out of Macon County, Illinois, the same county as which the legislative director, Mr. Hanley, is from with, same place that Julie Curry is from, which is, who was a state representative from that director, who is working in the governor's office. Nancy Bounds' deposition states that she did not provide the names. The names were provided to her from the governor's office, and her contact was Mr. Underwood. Mr. Underwood has no experience in personnel, no experience in corrections, and he doesn't really say that he selected the names. He indicates that Ms. Bounds gave him the names or gave him the positions. Now, you got to remember, at this point, nobody's talking to anybody, nor are there any discussions with a Mr. DiTella, with anybody in the operations side of the Department of Corrections, the paramilitary organization charged with the responsibility of not only maintaining the safety of inmates, but the safety of the correctional facility, correctional guards themselves. So you have these people that have no knowledge of the situation. And when Mr. Underwood is asked that he attend meetings at the office of the governor, he indicated that maybe less than 10. He can't recall a single instance of who he met with. He can't recall a single topic or where he met. Now, I've been in Springfield for 30-some years, and I can still tell you I've been in a lot of meetings in the state capitol. And maybe it's just me. Maybe I just find that the building's a big, august building to be there. But I would imagine if you're a newly hired employee, it lacks any credibility whatsoever. Nothing. So then you have Ms. Curry, and he's reporting to Ms. Curry. Ms. Curry is the one that's supposedly providing the directions. Now, there's nothing in writing. There's not a single piece of paper anywhere that says, we need a reduction in staff. This is your goal. Try to reduce this number of people. These people's names appeared on the list. Mr. Gunville was politically active and was known to be politically active. We know, or at least there's testimony in the record at this point, that there was some questions as to whether or not somebody requested lists, voting lists, whether those were there or not. Mr. Underwood just doesn't seem to recall much at all about anything. These two employees could not say and cannot say, we do, that there is, that this person said, I'm firing you or laying you off because you're a Republican or because you work for the Ryan administration. What we do able to establish is somebody asked for a list of the people who received promotions during the prior administration at the commencement. And then we have these series of actions resulting in a layoff without anybody putting anything in writing until there's a layoff list prepared by the Central Management Services.
Well, that's indicative of perhaps bad employment practices, but it doesn't establish a causal link to their political affiliation or lack of appropriate political affiliation.
I believe that the testimony of Ms. Curry was that she believed that the people were prior. The people there were all of the prior administration and had been Republican loyalists. But that, again, that's not, and I'm not saying, Your Honor, that is a specific I gotcha, for want of a better term. It's not. It is taking you back and looking at this. And at some point, the level of non-management, the level of just absolute lack of documentation is beyond belief, is beyond being believable. It is just, it only leads to one rational conclusion. What I keep thinking of when I look at this set of facts and have from the first day is a net worth tax case. Have no income, you have $5,000 of income, you live in a $400,000 house, you drive a Mercedes-Benz. There's a conclusion. We allow people to go to jail drawing those kinds of inferences. a jury could take a look at these facts. Maybe they will believe, Your Honor, that, in fact, this is just gigantic mismanagement. Nobody was home at the ship. Nobody put anything in writing. But we're talking about here a director of personnel for one of the major state agencies. We're talking about a deputy chief of staff in the governor's office. There are no records at all anywhere about this. We've asked. It lacks any and all credibility. And with regard to Mr. Oakley, they put him in Springfield for the recall list, Sangamon County. And there was a position that became available in Sangamon County. And then, lo and behold, although the employees were in Sangamon County, the subordinate employees that were supervised, and the work was in Sangamon County, and the job had been in Sangamon County, they transferred the job care classification to Adams County, put a person in that job in Adams County, and would not let Mr. Oakley apply for it. So without regard to whether or not the rule is, we challenge the rule or not, at least with regard to Mr. Oakley, he had a job that was there, and it wasn't there.
He had the job that supposedly a Republican filled.
Actually, Your Honor, it is correct, and I could probably go in more detail, but that is correct. I believe it's, there's much I think that's not in the record because things have occurred afterwards.
The only thing that's not, that's sort of obvious is that the Republicans were in the State House for about 20 years, weren't they?
They were, and there was that argument that everybody was a Republican.
Well, or something. That doesn't mean they're very loyal. They just happen to be that who's in charge. This is one of those things of a long time ago with the Rutan change things, and we live under a new era.
I
was personally raised in the old era, so I remember all of these things back in Indiana.
And I happen to be from Lake County, Indiana, and I remember those.
I can't measure up to that.
Well, and being in Springfield now in Sangamon County, I'm sort of same kind of place, I think, right now. But having said that,
your next move will have to be Newark, New Jersey.
I don't think so. No grandchildren there. Your Honor, the bottom line is that it lacks any credibility. And, you know, in criminal cases, you have cases all the time that are brought and are based upon a building block of starting with the basement and going up. If, in fact, no one will ever win these cases if you create no records and you don't tell the truth. And I don't have a grand jury available to me to be able to assist me in pursuing these cases for these individuals. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of the defendants, appellees. Your Honor,
were any Democrats laid off during this cost savings push?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know. I mean, the problem here, really the central problem in this case, is a failure of proof. This is, you know, this Court has said that summary judgment is the put up or shut up moment, and the plaintiffs just didn't put up. I mean, the record is rife with omissions, really. There's, for example, with regard to the recall, the only two defendants that could have been related to the recall, you know, are Walker and Ruman, but there's an agreement in the record on summary judgment that neither of them had personal knowledge or personal involvement. So any claim with regard to the plaintiffs and the decisions about their recall or non-recall. So there is no recall claim for failure of proof. Because neither Walker nor Ruman had any knowledge or involvement with the plaintiffs, then they certainly didn't with regard to the layoff because, you know, Ruman, everybody agrees, or all parties agree that Ruman didn't know and wasn't personally involved in the layoff of these plaintiffs.
Is personal involvement a requirement?
Oh, yes.
The claim is, well, it is for a claim in against a defendant in his or her individual capacity for damages, but what about a claim for prospective relief, an official capacity claim for prospective relief?
Well,
is,
Right. Well,
personal knowledge required for that?
No, but because you would have to have the predicate liability before you can have prospective relief, right? So you'd have to show that there was personal involvement to create the liability to allow for relief due to that injury.
Do we have a case that says that?
No, I'm just thinking logically.
Right, and this wasn't finished, so I'm just throwing it out there. But
right. I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, no, obviously, it seems to me obvious that if there is liability, if you can prove that the person who was in place at the time committed a Rutan violation, then there is either retrospective liability against that person, whether or not they're still in office, as an individual matter, and then if you need prospective relief, then against whoever is in the office. But you can't get relief without having proven your underlying claim, and that underlying claim requires personal involvement.
So there's like, no imputed knowledge theory in this area in an official capacity claim?
Where the defendant
is being sued in an official capacity for reinstatement, but some other actor had the requisite personal knowledge.
Right. I mean, I don't think, for example, the current CMS person, I mean, Walker was there, and you know, for the recall, and is still there, Director Walker at the corrections. But the Rumman, you know, Secretary, I can't remember, the head of CMS at the time of the recall is no longer at CMS. He's been replaced. So twice now, I think. So, but you would have needed to show that Rumman was liable, had personal involvement and personal knowledge, in order to get both prospective and retroactive relief.
What's the best evidence in the record that a material reorganization took place? I mean, are there memos? Is there testimony?
There is testimony, for example, that there from Ms. Bounds, I believe, that this went across there were 20 agents. Sorry, there were several agencies involved, so it's not just DOC, and that there were over in DOC in corrections alone, there were over 200 people. 200 people, 20 positions, over 200 people eliminated. Those positions were eliminated. So I think that the magnitude of this, again, the magnitude of this shows that there was reorganization. There were other things not in the record that we know, historical facts that we know that there were vetoes about funding and so on, that you know, the governor came in saying, I'm going to shrink government. And he did say, you know, I want you to, we don't have, I mean, there is testimony in the record, we don't have enough money to go until the end of the fiscal year, so there needs to be a rethinking of staffing and administration and so on. And to me, the reasonable inference from that is you have to cut your costs. And there are two ways to do that. I mean, you do it through programs or you do it through people.
What can we take from a fact that Mr. Gunvill is placed on a list for Kankakee?
Well,
and there are no DOC facilities in Kankakee. It's Alice in Wonderland, isn't it?
Well, no, I mean, because he was originally placed on that list before the layoff, before Governor Blagojevich came into office. So this because there were, in fact, there was a facility. So and the way the rule is interpreted by CMS is in a narrow fashion now is that you are put into the county that was the county on your job description, so that and the idea too is that they wanted to not force people to move. There was nothing here to prevent the plaintiff from applying for a new job in another county. I mean, other people did that. That's what Spalding did. He had been laid off. There was a job in Sangamon County. He was the guy who, you know, replaced. Okay. He saw that there was a job in Sangamon County, even though he was in Adams County. He applied for it, even though it wasn't in his county. So just because your job description was in one particular county doesn't mean that you can't apply for a job someplace else, which is really what and which is what happened, you know, in that case. So, but I think we need to really focus on the evidence here against these particular defendants.
Well, tell me this before we do that. Can you think of any proper purpose for pulling voter records? You seem to argue in the brief that pulling these records for other employees is irrelevant to these terminations for these plaintiffs. But if they pulled these for other employees, doesn't that create an inference that an improper basis was used for terminations generally? So let's assume for the purposes of my question right now that the plaintiffs have admissible evidence that the voter records were pulled.
That the captain's voting records were pulled.
Can you think of any proper purpose for pulling voters' voting records?
Your Honor, I can't think of a purpose for having done that, a related purpose, but what I can say is that the evidence in the record, the unrebutted evidence in the record, was that Mr. Underwood, who plaintiff attributes to making the decision, the initial decision about who got laid off at Corrections, the unrebutted evidence is that he did not know plaintiff's political affiliation. The reasonable inference from that is that their voting records were not pulled.
Well, but Kathleen Danner testified that Underwood told her how many captains were registered Republican versus Democrat.
Correct. And let's keep in mind, the only information he apparently conveyed to her, and again, it's hearsay, but the only information he conveyed to her was how many versus how many. He had a numbers knowledge, but he didn't convey a knowledge of any particular person, that he even had particular person's knowledge. And in addition, she testified that she did not know of any other voting records that had been pulled. And that coupled with, and that's unrebutted. So her unrebutted testimony that she didn't know any, she had not heard of any other voting, she did not know of any other voting records being pulled. And that was, again, her secondhand knowledge. And his testimony, Underwood's testimony, that he did not know the plaintiff's political affiliation. The only reasonable inference from that testimony, unrebutted testimony, is that Underwood, who made the first decision, did not know their political affiliation. And again, you know, the prima facie case here is simply not presented. This is a serious failure of proof case here. The plaintiff had to show that a defendant, not Underwood, not, you know, Julie Curry, not somebody else, but that the people that they chose to sue, that those people had personal knowledge and personal involvement in the layoff decisions or the recall decisions, and they simply failed to show either personal knowledge or personal involvement. In fact, plaintiff just admitted in his opening argument that he doesn't have evidence. Snyder testified unrebutted that he didn't know anything about the layoff list. And this is consistent with Underwood's testimony that he had not talked to Snyder about the layoff list. So the unrebutted testimony in this case doesn't allow the inference that any defendant here actually knew or was actually involved in the decision-making process and based that decision, the layoff decision, of these two people, much less the 200-plus other, you know, people, the 20 positions and so on, that those were based on political decisions. Again, there has to be this causal link, and you can't make the causal link if you don't have the knowledge and you didn't participate. You know, you're the wrong defendant if you didn't have the if you're not shown to have had the personal knowledge and made the personal action, you're the wrong defendant here.
So who would have been the right defendant here?
Well, under plaintiff's theory, it would seem to me that they would have had to show that the people in the chain of the decision making, that was Underwood, you know, Ms. Bounds, the two of them worked together, but let's say that Underwood was the piston here. Okay, he sent it to Curry, to Ms. Curry. She approved it, and then it went back to CMS, the layoff, and then the ministerial stuff was done. You know, Ms. Bounds did the layoff packages and so on. So those people, according to the theory that the plaintiff presented, those people are the people who apparently should have been the defendants here. Now, I don't know that they should have been the defendants here. I don't know personally know that they are. But according to the evidence that the plaintiffs presented, they seem to be the decision makers here. It certainly wasn't Snyder. The unrebutted testimony is that he didn't have any involvement in the layoffs. And the agreement, the undisputed fact, you know, plaintiffs did not dispute any of our facts. And one of our facts was neither Walker nor Ruman, the director of the department now of corrections and the director of CMS for both the recall and the layoff, that neither of them had personal involvement or personal knowledge. So those are clearly the wrong defendants for any relief here. The only
Who's the appointing authority?
I'm sorry?
I understand the evidence as to who actually made the decisions about what positions went on the list, and that seems to have been conducted out of the governor's office. But who's the appointing authority? Who actually has the statutory authority to hire and fire, or regulatory authority to hire and fire?
It's a pretty complicated chain. Apparently, a supervisor, they'll be like the first level, particularly for civil service people.
If they're suing for prospective injunctive relief to be rehired, who is responsible for signing that piece of paper?
Well, I think their theory is, I'll answer your question, but I'm not actually sure. I don't recall if that paper is in the record. But their theory is that Snyder was sort of a cat's paw here. But Snyder, the unrebutted evidence is Snyder wasn't informed, wasn't involved, didn't know their political affiliations.
I understand that. What I'm getting at is the identity of the proper defendant for purposes of prospective injunctive relief is the one who's in charge of ultimate act of hiring and firing from
of
the state.
Of pulling somebody back, you mean?
Right, is the personnel director, right?
I would
personnel manager or somebody else? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. To tell you the truth, I don't know. I mean, standing here, I don't know, and I don't know if that evidence is in the record.
This gets back to my earlier point,
right?
That hasn't been briefed, but if that's the claim.
Mm-hmm.
Then is there any support for the proposition that that person must have personal knowledge if there is proof that the people who actually made the decision had personal knowledge?
Well,
or at least one of them here, Snyder.
Right.
In the case of one of the plaintiffs.
Well, I would go back in that, again, we have to look at who was sued here, and so those are the people from whom the plaintiffs are seeking relief, right? And relief because they're alleging that these defendants, they have to prove that these defendants, because they were the people who were there on the ground at the time, right, on the ground during the layoff, on the ground during the 2-year recall period, that those people are the people who have personal knowledge and personal involvement, and those people are simply not. There's just no evidence in the record that the recall people, which are only current Director Walker, because he came in the day, pretty much the day after the layoff, and Ruman, who was there throughout the 2-year layoff period. Those are the people against that you would have to find were liable under for the recall problem before you could give prospective relief for the recall problem. Okay? And so I guess I'm having trouble understanding your question because it seems to me that the underlying predicate for your question is to show that some defendant has liability even though somebody might have replaced that defendant in an official capacity later on for prospective relief. So your question, I don't understand your question to include the underlying liability, which would in turn require personal knowledge.
Well, there is proof that Snyder knew of the political affiliation of one of these plaintiffs, right?
There is evidence in the record that approximately 5 years before the layoff, somebody described or introduced Mr. Gunville to Director Snyder as Mr. Young Republican. So, but if you can't have, if a 14-month gap between a political event and the, you know, the alleged discrimination is too long, and that's true under the you know, Roger Whitmore case, then a 5-year attenuation seems to be too much. If there are no further questions, we just ask the court. There's just all that's here is generic atmospheric speculation or evidence, and then leading to speculation. And really, on summary judgment, you have to show more than that. So we ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Welsh. You had 2 minutes, but we gave Ms. Welsh extra time. So we will give you.
I will be very pointed.
The same extra time.
First, in answer to your question, Judge Sykes, we're taking, if we had not named them, and if we had gotten to the point where we had gotten a judgment and we wanted them to be reinstated, I am quite sure the Office of the Attorney General would say, there's nobody here to reinstate. That's one. It's for prospective relief. They didn't have.
I do not understand your answer.
In other words, the person, the actor, and in fact, if the case was remanded, we'd have to change to the current director of CMS in order to effectuate a reinstatement. We'd have to have the current director named. That's the reason for that, them being involved in their official capacities. With respect to the actor that took care of laying these people off, there's a single layoff list. The layoff list we're talking about is in the record. It's about 20, 25 people. It's not 200 people. Don't know anything about the sergeants. Wasn't part of the exam, part of any of the discovery. They were laid off by Donald Snyder. That's who their, in fact, their employer was. That's who we sued. We don't know Mr. Underwood. And in fact, to be honest with you, Mr. Underwood has no authority to do, at the time, to do anything other than process the paper. And what involvement the governor's office has in any of these layoffs and directing them is absolutely zero under the law. I don't live in some sort of ivory tower.
Mr. Feldman, then isn't it a tremendous problem that you never deposed Mr. Snyder, if this is so?
Mr. Snyder did whatever he was told, and everybody says that the layoff list was...
But what we just sit up here and say to each other, well, Mr. Snyder did whatever he was told.
And he signed the he was given the layoff list. He has testified he had no involvement with it. He signed the layoff letters. And they don't contain, just so everybody's clear, they don't contain any notation that they were done by anybody but him, just only his signature. You know, he was aware of the layoff. He signed the layoff. Layoff was prepared under him. And to be honest with you, Your Honor, when we first started that, we didn't know who. We didn't know. And today I can still tell you I have no clue who specifically designed this layoff list. Because quite honestly, there is nobody that has told us what took place in those 10 meetings that occurred at the office of the governor. And information that clearly has come out since that is not part of this record indicates that that is very critical. So if, in fact, if you say you don't have any pieces of paper and you say I don't recall and I don't know 40-some times, you can get away with defeating these types of claims. And that's what's taken place. Thank you. I won't take any more of the court's time.
Thank you, Mr. Feldman, and thank you, Ms. Welsh. And the case will be taken under advisement.